The Battle for Liberty, Episode 36.
This is the Battle for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Battle for Liberty. Once again, I'm your host, Mike Tilden. Thanks so much for joining me on the podcast dedicated to the journey of the libertarian novice. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. If you could do me one better, tell a friend about the show. Go ahead and spread the word about the Battle for Liberty. We're growing every month, and you're a big part of that, so thanks to everyone who have made a reference already. If you've done it already, guess what? I want you to do it again. As always, check out the site at battleforliberty.com. You should follow me on Twitter at @MyBattleLiberty, and you should like the Facebook page. That's facebook.com/battleforliberty. If you want to send me an email, that's easy too. It's mike@battleforliberty.com. And there will be a show notes page for this episode, as always. That'll be battleforliberty.com/36. And that's that one convenient location for all of the content that I will talk about on this episode. All right, folks, you ready? You ready for this headline? I'm going to jump right into it here. Headline: John Deere just told the Copyright Office that only corporations can own property. Humans can just license it. Well, if that isn't a perfect jumping off point for a discussion about intellectual property, I'm not quite sure what else would be better. So that's what we're going to be discussing today, the idea of intellectual property. And don't worry, we will talk about that article towards the end of the episode. But before we do that, I think it's a good idea that we review the entire concept of intellectual property to begin with. You see, after I've done some digging, it turns out that just like everything else that's considered to be common sense nowadays, well, there's a lot more to the topic of intellectual property than I was taught in school. And I think that's probably true for you as well. So, in order to get the full scoop on intellectual property, I've decided I'm going to use the work of Stephen Kinsella. Stephen Kinsella is one of the foremost authorities on intellectual property in the libertarian universe today. Stephen Kinsella is a Houston-based attorney who specializes in intellectual property. He's the director of the Center for the Study of Innovative Freedom, and he's the editor of Libertarian Papers. Now, all of that is going to be linked in the show notes page at battleforliberty.com/36. Now, the chief reference that I'll be using for the vast majority of this episode is Kinsella's book titled Against Intellectual Property, which is available for free as an ebook from the Mises Institute website, which, of course, I will also be linking to from the show notes page. So, let's dive right in. When you think of intellectual property, what do you think of? Well, I don't know about you, but even as recent ago as 3 or 4 months, I had a notion of intellectual property that I think you probably share. So if you're thinking that intellectual property, you know, has something to do with the idea that if someone comes up with an invention, or if they discover a unique or secret formula or recipe, or if they write a song or a poem or a book or something creative, if they go to all that work, then that person has the exclusive right to that invention or that formula or that artistic creation, at least for a certain amount of time. And indeed, if that's what you think, then that's roughly how intellectual property is thought of today. So you're in good company. It turns out the notion is even enshrined in the U.S. Constitution. Some people don't know that, but it is right there in Article 1, Section 8. It's Clause Number 8. And it states very clearly that the Congress shall have the power, quote, to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries, end quote. So this is where the federal government draws its authority over copyrights and patents, among other types of intellectual property law. Now, you'll hear on this show that many times I talk about how the federal government grabs power that it was never intended to have, because aside from my anarchistic tendencies, which by now you know are quite numerous, I also have a huge interest in constitutionality and centralization and federal power versus state power. So it's very common to hear me talk about instances where the federal government has grabbed a power that it's never been given. But in this particular instance, that's not the case. The federal government was actually delegated the authority to do things like grant copyrights and patents. It's right there in Article 1, Section 8. So I have no argument whether or not it's constitutional for the federal government to be involved in copywriting. That would be a silly argument to try to make. But I do have an argument whether or not copywriting is a good idea and is in line with proper libertarian principles. Interesting question, right? But already, I think I've gone a little bit too far. We need to get much more basic before we dive in so deep. So let's start at the very beginning. We're going to start with exactly what is intellectual property. Well, according to Kinsella, intellectual property is a broad concept that covers several types of legally recognized rights arising from some type of intellectual creativity or that are otherwise related to ideas. Intellectual property rights are rights to intangible things, to ideas as expressed or as embodied in a practical implementation. So copyrights would cover the former, to ideas as they are expressed. Things like books, articles, movies, music, poems, things that are considered to be original works. And what a copyright does is it gives an author an exclusive right to copy or to perform that original work, hence copyright. They are the only person with the right to copy. This effectively grants a legal monopoly to the original author. Now, copyrights are permitted to last about 70 years past the life of the author. So if I copyright something and then I keel over and die, my copyright lasts for an additional 70 years. Now, if a corporation does it, they get a total of 95 years. A little bit different, but very similar. Patents, on the other hand, cover the latter of the two that I just talked about. So things that are embodied in a practical implementation would be covered by patents. So they deal with physical inventions as opposed to original creative works. Remember, creative works were covered under copyright, whereas physical embodiments or practical implementations are covered by patents. Now, patents give an exclusive property right to inventors over the manufacture, use, or sale of the patented invention. Now, there are a few things that should be noted that simply can't be patented. The U.S. Supreme Court has explicitly stated that there are three categories of things that cannot be patented. Those three things are the laws of nature, natural phenomena, and abstract ideas. None of those three things can be patented. The key, though, is to take some abstract idea and then turn it into a useful, tangible, describable result. That result would be called an invention, which of course can be patented. Now, patents currently last 20 years from the date of the original filing of the patent. And during those 20 years, no one else is permitted to manufacture, sell, or even use the patented product in a contradictory fashion opposed to what the manufacturer originally intended. So this is a very powerful monopoly that's been granted, whether it's copyright or a patent. Now, it's important to understand there are a few other categories of intellectual property, namely trade secrets and trademarks, but we're going to skip them for this episode for the sake of brevity. Intellectual property is a truly massive subject, and I really want to get to the meat of our exploration. So just know that trade secrets and trademarks are both covered in Stefan Kinsella's book, Against Intellectual Property, and you should read about them at your convenience. Remember, go over to the Mises website and look for Against Intellectual Property. And if you don't remember that, just go to battleforliberty.com/36 and there'll be a link to the book right there. So you don't really need to remember anything else other than battleforliberty.com/36. Okay, now I think it's reasonable to say that we've covered the very, very basic idea of what intellectual property is, and two of the most common forms of it, namely copyright and patent. So now that we have a better understanding of what IP law is all about, let's talk about libertarianism in general. So, you know, if you know anything about libertarianism, and if you know anything about myself in particular, if you're a regular listener to the show, you should be thinking to yourself right about now, well, gee, this intellectual property thing sounds great. I mean, it sounds like it's protecting property rights, and that's always a good thing, right? And truthfully, for the majority of my life, that is precisely what I thought. I thought intellectual property laws were perfectly in line with freedom and with property rights, and that they helped foster an innovative and free market, the likes of which the world had never seen. But, as I said earlier, it turns out that with a little digging, there's a lot more to this story. What I've come to discover is that there is actually a very compelling argument to be made that intellectual property laws are actually antithetical to the principles of liberty. But before I tell you all about how that's the case, I want to talk to you very briefly about something that I need your help with. If you're a listener of this show, if you're a regular listener, you know the Battle for Liberty is a free podcast. You can go over to battleforliberty.com and you can listen to the podcast for free. You can subscribe on iTunes, you subscribe on Stitcher, you can get the emails, you can do everything that I offer for free. What you might not know is that it does actually cost me something to keep this thing going. And while I've made a commitment that I will never charge anything to my weekly loyal listeners, I am going to ask that those of you who feel like you can contribute to start helping me out. See, I think it's the case that there's some listeners in this show who wouldn't mind throwing a couple bucks a month towards me to help me pay for this endeavor. So, head on over to battleforliberty.com and you'll see a brand new button in the menu bar that says support the show. From that link, you'll be able to access my Patreon page and in the very near future, my affiliates. You'll be able to enter amazon.com and everything you buy on Amazon will help me pay for the show. I'll have some new and exciting affiliates coming to you in the coming months, but the Patreon page is already set up. So if you want to support the show, and I know there are some of you out there that do want to support the show, you can start with as little as $1 a month. I'm telling you, you can't underestimate how important $1 a month would be for me. That'll help me keep the site going. It'll pay for web hosting and podcast hosting and equipment every now and then. So please check it out, battleforliberty.com. Click on the button that says support the show. All right, back to the topic. Where I left off was we were talking about the fact that I think there's a very compelling argument to be made that intellectual property laws are actually antithetical to the principles of liberty. Now, that statement might shock you. It certainly shocked me the first time I read it when I first began reading about the complexities and the counterarguments to intellectual property laws. So what I'd like to do for the rest of the episode is start with the conclusion that Kinsella comes to at the end of his book and work backwards from there. It might seem an odd way to do it, but I think you'll understand why I'm doing it this way. So the conclusion that Kinsella reaches at the end of his book is that a system of property rights that deals in ideal objects necessarily requires the violation of other individual property rights, that is, the right to use one's own tangible property as one sees fit, and therefore, intellectual property rights cannot be justified. All right, that's quite a conclusion. And from there, I want to go through some of the objections that I had in my mind when I read that conclusion. See, I had to read this book a couple times before I really started to understand it. So, in order to show you that there's at least a solid argument to be made in favor of Kinsella's conclusion, I'm going to go through the objections I had, and we'll go through them one by one. So, first, let's tackle the philosophical side. So, The objection to Kinsella's conclusion would be, well, wait a minute, don't intellectual property laws help protect private property? And isn't that completely in line with libertarian principles? I mean, why would someone like Kinsella write an entire book called Against Intellectual Property? What is he, some sort of pinko commie? Well, no, he's actually quite far from being a commie. Let's think about this in more depth to see why. Remember first that the libertarian principle of property rights stems from natural rights theory, which states that first and foremost, you own yourself. That is a natural right. No one else can claim ownership over you. So you own yourself. And if you own yourself, then naturally you must also believe that you own whatever it is that you create. If you mix your labor, so to speak, with a tree that you already justly and rightly own, and from the mixture of your labor with that tree, you come away with a wooden beam suitable for building a house, then you rightly own that wooden beam as well. But the beam is physical, and no one else can own it unless you transfer the property right to them in whatever way you see fit. You can give it to them, you can sell it to them, any number of ways you can dispose of your property right. But when you transfer that right, however you do it, you physically give up the wooden beam, and now it belongs with that other person, and then they can do whatever they want with it. And it's right here where applications of property rights in regards to physical property and those in regards to intellectual property must necessarily diverge. And that's because when we talk about intellectual property, we're now dealing with ideas or ideals. We're talking about abstractions, not physical property. There are differences. So let's say I invent a new formula for a soft drink. I haven't actually created a physical item, have I? I've created an idea for creating a type of arrangement of physical items that will make another physical item. It's much more about the formula or the ideal or the idea. But there aren't any characteristics of ideas that match those of the physical items we talked about before, like wooden beams or trees or something of that nature. So first of all, let me explain that to you, see if you can understand it. First, if I tell someone about my new formula for this soft drink, well, then he owns that idea just as much as I do. It's in his head just as much as it's in my head. That's the ownership of that idea. His ownership of the formula doesn't diminish my ownership of it. So it's very much possible for both of us to possess that formula at the exact same time. This is very different from the wooden beam. Only one of us can hold on to the wooden beam. But with ideas and abstractions, once you tell someone, it doesn't detract from your ownership of that abstraction. They still own it, just like you still own it. But if the state comes along and grants me an exclusive right to that soft drink formula, or the idea for how to create certain physical objects, then in effect, the state is granting me a right to the precise pattern of physical ingredients that make up this soft drink, and by implication, the state then is also granting me a right to every physical embodiment of that formula, even if those other embodiments were created by other people with their own justly acquired physical property. So, indirectly, IP laws effectively give inventors and authors the right over an unknown number of other individuals' physical property and what they can do with it. So you are transferring the right to physical property from potentially millions of people to one person. Let's take another example. So if a copyright is granted to a book that you wrote, and then you sell the book to me, I am prevented by copyright law from making a copy of the book for any reason whatsoever. So, in effect, the state has given you property rights over an item that I have justly acquired. It's my book. I can do with it what I want. And the state says, no, 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 that's not true. The author actually owns a vast majority of that book and what you can do with it. Sure, you can read it and you can carry it in your backpack. That's all well and good. But if you want to copy it so that maybe you're protecting it from a fire, No, you can't do that. Well, you've restricted my ownership in my physical property. So when we think about how this compares to physical property rights as governed by the principles of natural rights, we simply cannot tolerate the ideas behind intellectual property rights. After all, when you acquire property justly, you should have the right to dispose of that property however you see fit. The notion that some person or company owns a portion of your physical property is some odd version of communal ownership of physical property. And I need to remind you that some people call communal ownership communism. So if previously you thought someone like Stefan Kinsella might be a communist for opposing IP laws, well, the truth turns out to be almost the exact opposite, that those of you who support IP laws are actually a tad closer to communism than those who oppose them. Fascinating, isn't it, how often we find that it's precisely the opposite of what's so-called common sense that turns out to be the truth? I think so. All right, I think that covers the basic understanding of intellectual property from a philosophical side and why some libertarians oppose intellectual property laws. And that's a very important start. From there, we need to start asking some more probing questions about the effects of intellectual property laws. So next, let's ask, well, don't intellectual property laws help encourage innovation? And if an inventor wasn't completely sure that he or she would be able to reap the rewards of the years and years of thankless, expensive research and development, then wouldn't there be a sharp decrease in the quality and quantity of new inventions? And wouldn't that invariably lead to a worse quality of life and overall less wealth than would have otherwise existed? Okay, those are all fantastic questions. So let's examine the claims themselves. It certainly seems plausible that intellectual property laws would encourage innovation. That seems like common sense, doesn't it? That's what I was always taught. And maybe they do, at least on a certain level. But that's not the whole question. We need to look back at Henry Hazlitt and Frederick Bastiat to remember that you have to look at the entire picture. There's more to it than just whether or not there's a small amount of innovation that's encouraged. No, in actuality, there are two fundamental questions we need to ask. First, do intellectual property laws actually cause an increase in innovation? And second, does the possible increase in innovation that's encouraged by intellectual property laws outweigh the enormous cost of an intellectual property system of justice? Ah, now those are some interesting questions. All right, one at a time. First, let's start with whether or not IP laws actually cause an increase in innovation or in overall wealth. So the answer to this one, it turns out, is, well, we just don't know. There's really no data to support the assertion that IP laws have any effect at all on innovation or on the wealth of a society, whether they're positive or negative effects. There's just nothing that shows any statistical effect at all. So it's quite debatable whether or not IP laws are necessary to encourage innovation. There are plenty of studies that have been done, but none of them conclusively show that IP laws have an effect one way or another. And that is completely contrary to everything I've ever been taught about copyrights and patents. Let's take, for example, the notorious example given by most proponents of the intellectual property system, the pharmaceutical industry. See, the story goes like this. Without IP laws and without pharmaceutical companies obtaining an exclusive right to their inventions, then free riders would simply wait for a successful compound to be invented, and then they'd jump on board without having to do any of the work, and they'd be able to compete and produce the compound for a whole lot cheaper, and then the original inventor would never be able to recoup the massive costs of the research and development of that compound. So, knowing this, most pharmaceutical companies would have very little incentive to innovate or, you know, in their eyes, they wouldn't want to waste their money inventing new, potentially life-saving drugs if some other company can just come along, take their invention, and make money off of it while they struggle in all of the expenses that they incurred. And again, this is a quite compelling argument, one that has certainly made sense to me for many, many years. But it surprised me to learn that in countries such as Switzerland, Italy, and Germany, there were no strict patent protections during the 20th century. And during that same period of time, those countries were the most innovative pharmaceutical producers. Furthermore, something like 17 out of the top 20 medical innovations in the last 100 years had nothing to do with patents. That's amazing information that flies in the face of what we think about what might happen without intellectual property. Now, I can't go through all of the examples piece by piece, but I do want to refer you over to a very interesting book by Boldrin and Levine called Against Intellectual Monopoly. Specifically, Chapter 9 deals with the pharmaceutical industry, and in that chapter, you can learn all about how all of the preconceptions that you might have about the pharmaceutical industry in particular in regards to intellectual property are pretty much false. So head on over to battleforliberty.com/36 and you can check out that book. It's also free in an ebook format as well. All right, now let's deal with the second fundamental question. Does the possible increase in innovation that's encouraged by IP laws outweigh the huge cost of an intellectual property system of justice? And again, I hate to be a wet blanket here. The answer is we simply don't know. But again, this is a far cry from the air of certainty that an intellectual property system must be totally justified, right? That's the common theme that you'll hear over and over again. It's virtually certain. Well, the truth is it's not virtually certain. And think about it this way. The vast majority of players in the intellectual property system of justice happen to be lawyers who do nothing but seek ways to either protect inventions or defend against accusations that intellectual property laws were violated. There's even a term, believe it or not, in the IP justice system for people who do nothing but create patents for inventions that they've never created and never intend to create, but merely thought about them. They're called patent trolls, and their entire living is based on suing people for patent infringement on something that they never intended to invent in the first place. All they had to do was think of something, file a patent, and wait for someone to infringe upon it, and then boom, there's their money. So let's think about how much money is dedicated to the intellectual property system that, if it was freed up, could instead be used on innovation and figuring out how to improve inventions that have already been made, regardless of whether or not the predicate device happens to be patented. Think about how many companies and individual inventors don't even look at predicate patented devices because they're terrified of a lawsuit. They won't even try. That to me sounds like stifled innovation, not encouraged. I mean, wouldn't you prefer that a company devoted its full time and money to the innovation and product improvement rather than to the ridiculous amount of lawyers and lawsuits that protect the monopoly that they've held on an invention that could be 15 years old at this point? Believe it or not, it's been estimated that the patent system alone imposes at least $300 billion on the U.S. economy in lost innovation, cost of attorneys' fees, litigation, and barriers to entry. So the bottom line here is that we can't actually make the claim that IP laws encourage greater innovation or an increase in the overall wealth of a society. And it could be the case that it actually costs way more money to support the IP justice system than if we didn't have one at all, and that extra money could cause an improvement in greater innovation. So again, it could be the opposite. So if that's the case, why would we continue to cling to the utilitarian claim that IP laws result in a certain specific desirable outcome? We just don't know that that's true. Again, fascinating information. But let's pretend for a moment that we can say that those things are true. So even if those claims were true, even if it could be shown that intellectual property laws result in more numerous and better quality inventions and that the IP system is cost effective, if we could make those claims, those would still be nothing more than utilitarian arguments. See, I could quite easily come up with several anti-libertarian policies that might help increase innovation. For example, I could advocate protectionist policies that require a certain number of dollars in taxation to be dedicated solely to medical research, or spaceflight, or artistic education, or a better type of Velcro, or whatever. For sure, that would have some sort of positive effect in at least a small area of innovation. But that doesn't make those policies any more in line with the principles of liberty. As we've discussed numerous times on this show, utilitarian arguments are frequently appealing because they lure you in with a promise of beneficial and liberating results. You know, supporting IP laws will lead to greater innovation. Well, that sounds great. But don't ever forget the problems with utilitarianism. As we've learned time and time again, sometimes those supposedly beneficial results of interventionist policies turn out to have unforeseen consequences. I've already referenced it once, but it bears referencing again. That's a lesson we should have learned from Frederick Bastiat and Henry Hazlitt. A lesson that we've seen applied time and time again. On this show, we just saw it applied as early as episode 31, in which I showed you that one of Milton Friedman's utilitarian ideas went horribly awry and wound up giving us the ever-growing bloated government subsidy called the Earned Income Tax Credit. The Earned Income Tax Credit, if you remember, was supposed to have wonderful, liberating and freeing consequences, but it turned out to be just the opposite. And what I'm asking you to do is see that the intellectual property argument is a utilitarian argument that is having deleterious effects. So please don't ever forget, the safest way to ensure a lasting, unencumbered freedom for the most amount of people is to stick to the principles and stop focusing on some promised wonderful result. It almost never turns out that way if you stray from the principles. All right, so now that we've reviewed some potential reasons why one might oppose intellectual property laws, let's get back to the article that brought this topic to the forefront of my mind. Remember, the title of the article was, "John Deere just told the Copyright Office that only corporations can own property, humans can only license it." So what's basically going on here is a legal battle that's been raging for a number of years. It started with automotive manufacturers and spread to smartphone makers and computer companies, and now it's even rearing its ugly head in the farm equipment industry. Basically, these companies are trying to make the argument that when you buy a Mercedes or an iPhone or now a John Deere tractor, because all of those devices are heavily reliant on software, you haven't actually purchased a physical item. You don't actually own those cars or those phones or those tractors. No, what they claim is that you have purchased a license to use the property and its software, but only within the terms of a software licensing agreement. And furthermore, the companies maintain that under copyright law, they retain the exclusive right to dictate how that item can be used, how it will be repaired, how you can modify it, if you can modify it at all, and whether or not any non-manufacturer parts can be used in conjunction with them. And the worst part about it is that the U.S. Copyright Office hasn't immediately thrown out the claim. They've been entertaining this claim for years, which means there's at least a moderate chance that they could agree with the companies seeking these legal rights over property that you have justly acquired. Folks, this is just another series of unintended consequences of the utilitarian argument. How many times must we see that straying from the basic principles of liberty leads to untold injustices down the road? I know it might be uncomfortable for you to ditch your long-standing approval of intellectual property protection, but if you can come to understand and accept that there is neither a natural right nor a utilitarian justification for the intellectual property system, then you'll have no choice to leave it in the dustbin of history where it belongs. Well, what do you think? Are you convinced? Or am I a total nutcase? Or have you never thought about this before and now, you know, you're just going to distill it for a little while? Well, that's okay if you need to distill it for a little while. I've had to do that myself. Remember, I told you I had to read that book a couple times before I started to agree with a lot of it. Regardless, I want to hear your opinion. I want to hear from you. Get in touch with me on Twitter at MyBattleLiberty or at Facebook.com/BattleForLiberty or via email at Mike@BattleForLiberty.com. And please don't forget, there is a jam-packed show notes page for this episode, accessible at battleforliberty.com/36. You're gonna want to check that one out. Stephen Kinsella's book is available there, as well as every other reference that I've made during this episode. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher, and please refer a friend. Finally, please send us a positive review on either iTunes or Stitcher. Let's get some 5-star ratings in the record books. That will do wonders for me and for the search results when people search for libertarian-themed podcasts. Keep spreading the word about the battle for liberty. You're doing a great job of that. And until next time, battle on.